We're here to talk about billion-dollar insights on why AI fails and human innovation wins. And I'm really pleased to be joined by Katz Keeley, a 20-year transformation pioneer who has driven large-scale change for the UN, the BBC, and GSK, to name a few. And I'm also joined by Stephen J. Manning, who built a billion-dollar marketing business. So this is going to be... So, yeah, I mean, let's get into the big question. What's the biggest AI implementation failure you've witnessed, and what went wrong, Stephen? I know you've got an example there somewhere.
Well, I have a number of them, whether they're a billion or more, or they will be billions or more. One of the things that you pointed to me was General Motors. You pointed me to the cruise experience, the self-driving autonomous vehicle division. To me, that ended up being in the same category as shiny pennies, meaning, everybody wants to do the new thing. The new thing is too compelling to ignore. Now, AI is too compelling to ignore. However, misusing AI is just characteristic. It's awful. It changes the dynamics of companies, changes the dynamics of human interaction, changes the dynamics of innovation, to be sure. You know, when GM plopped down $10 billion to develop autonomous-driven automobiles was a dream. Now, let's put that in context. They did that in 2016, 17, 18, thereabouts. Today, what is Elon Musk doing with self-driving automobiles? He believes he's at the infancy of that particular revolution. So there's GM in cahoots with a couple of major investment companies, mind you, who are not used to losing a great deal of money, went ahead on this incredible journey, and one, they were not really genuinely committed. Financially, yes, but from a talent perspective, they were not. In fact, it ended up being a drain on talent. They were so far ahead. They were ahead, years ahead. Now, you know, one of the reasons why businesses fail is because there's no take in the marketplace. The marketplace is not quite ready for that. I admit that I have not been in a Waymo yet, a self-driven taxi cab or livery car in Los Angeles. There's something about that thing that, as much as I may understand, it troubles me. And I do understand the statistics. The auto taxi cab, the auto delivery car is significantly safer on LA roads than a car that a driver might drive. There are a couple of little things there that Katz, you will relate to, that trouble me, which is there are some decisions that are being made by that enterprise, the self-driving thing, that I'm not so sure I know how to fit into. In other words, there's the quintessential example. The autonomous car is driving down the road and encounters a catastrophic event and has to run over one or two things. A woman with a child in a little push thing, or the past or soon-to-be Nobel Prize winner in something. And then the decision has to be made, which one do you run over? And how is the algorithm built to instantly recognize the value of that versus the value of that? And that's a decision that has to be made. Those things trouble me. But, you know, back to the core point is, it's interesting that General Motors has gone down that road, Nathaniel, that you pointed out to me, the cruise. GM has done that before, and they ignored some, I had the pleasure once to meet Roger Smith, who lectured me on what GM really did for a living. They're really money lending and real estate and make cars. But there was a time when he created Saturn Motors because he was no longer able to make change with the GM fast enough. He created Saturn. He put a bunch of money into it in the early 90s and created what made all the sense in the world. Unfortunately, the most critical part of the formula failed, people. He could not, the culture, he was trying to get away from the GM culture, from the mature GM culture to something new. Well, that culture didn't materialize in Saturn. And of course, internal conflicts, management didn't like that he was so sterile as businesses go. Your unions didn't like it, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, it went bust, losing enormous amounts of money. That is, it's fascinating. The basic question is, didn't GM just do the same thing with a cruise? And you know what? Is there anything GM can't do well? Theoretically, they can do everything well. Having said that, GM and 90 other Fortune 1000s have been in divestiture mode rather than acquisition mode outside their core competencies. You know, we can make a hell of an automobile, but we don't know how to run a string of grain mills in the southern states, but we can buy it. And the biggest problem, of course, is the brain drain, because all the executives, all the smart people gravitate to the shiny penny. And what happens? They do that poorly, and then the mothership suffers.
Yeah, you raised some very important points there, actually. I mean, unfortunately, it led to a complete suspension of its permits because the cruise vehicle struck and dragged a pedestrian down the street, I think, and it was shut down by GM in late 2024. But they hemorrhaged so much cash. They spent so much money between 2018 and 2022, totaling $5 billion in losses. That's an estimate of 1.5 million per day. But I mean, there are bigger things behind the reason that it, well, not bigger things, but there are other complexities, aren't there, Katz, behind the reason that it failed. Could you explain the behavioral science behind why that failed?
Having worked in digital transformation for the last 20 years, I think that the challenges that we've been facing as leaders are going to become more and more challenging as we move forward into the age of AI. And you asked, you know, what of the kind of the big disasters that happened recently? And the ones that I pulled out was Babylon Health, which was 4.2 billion at one point, who were going to revolutionize health with AI. And it was all going so well. And then they obviously filed for bankruptcy. Why? I think it was partially to do with the fact they actually forgot about the user. They forgot about the way that the system worked. They were so focused on the tech. They forgot about what the tech was for. It's like, what is the why? Why would people want to use it? How do you make sure they get over their change resistance? And then IBM Watson, of course, it's another amazing AI that was going to do everything. We were over-promising, and it was going to do everything for everybody. But I don't really know whether it ever had a particular use case or whether they were really listening to what people needed and whether they were starting with a customer. And then there's...
On the IBM Watson thing, it's an interesting thing because they took me to Wimbledon a couple of times, and I went down to the basement, and they have this massive tech basement down there with all this great, great technology. And they gave me this picture here that was made from lots of different pictures. I think it's 8,400 pictures to make this tennis court, right? And that was in 2018. So I actually spoke to IBM Watson because they'd created a chatbot, and they told me that it was created by IBM Watson, basically, that was using this chatbot, right? And it had two or three different settings. So basically you could talk to it as if you were a tennis expert, or you could talk to it as if you were me, and I'm not a tennis expert at all. And I did find it quite interesting, but I also tried out the IBM Watson in terms of the data and manipulating my data and then uploading it, and found that extremely difficult to get on with. So I don't quite know what happened there. I know they sold part of it off. I don't know what they actually sold, because it was a bit under the table, sort of quite a quiet kind of retreat, I think, in that department.
Yeah, I think what was reported is there were 75% of their worth was lost over a couple of years through not really having a clear use case, not really asking people what they needed. You know, and then there's the stuff that's been happening recently with Klarna, companies that are going, you know, this AI can deal with 700 customers, and therefore we're going to get rid of all of our people because we don't need people. Oof. People are not needed. So they got rid of all the people, and guess what? The customers didn't like it. So now they're bringing people back in. Now that's problematic because it's not just about the fact they've gotten rid of people. They have destroyed trust in the people that were left. And it takes a very long time to build trust back into a culture. So that in itself, and more people are again trying to, they're not clear about what the why is. Where are we trying to get to? How do we augment the brilliance of humans with AI? What's our why? And then there was the more prosaic one recently with Deloitte. You know, it's a tiny challenge, but they're giving a report to the government in Australia. And because of the way Deloitte works, obviously the partners sell to the client and then they give all the work to the kids. The kids don't know how AI works, so they trust everything implicitly and they pack the report full of hallucinations. And that's, you know, it's only a $440,000 contract that didn't get paid. But what's it done to their reputation? Across the whole of the world, this is just stupidity by leaders as well. And I think the point really that I'd like to make, and I'm banging on about at the moment, is since the beginning of my career in digital transformation, where I genuinely believed that it was going to make us all more productive and happy, and we were going to have more time free, and things were going to be simpler, and we were going to be more communicative and collaborative, which is all the stuff I worked on. If you look at the data in one way, yes, we are the graphs that we're seeing, you know, the productivity is going up and the amount of people that we're hiring is kind of flattening off. So that's great, right? Less people, more productivity. But then you look at the other data, engagement's gone down and down and down and down over the last 25 years. The last report was 77% of the workforce feel that they're burning out. Just in the UK alone, we're talking about 21.6 billion wasted on stress. And what I hear from the people I work with all of the time is the change after the change after the change that keeps being foisted upon them leaves them in a situation where we've never felt so alone, never felt so disconnected. This is not good for business. So we were trying to digitize work. What we've digitized is overwhelm. So talk about a $1 billion failure. That's it.
May I?
Please.
Venture forth here. I think what you said is so on point. I have nothing to add to that. Going back a bit in time, if you allow me, there's a part of this revolution, if you will, that many of us who are in it, who are in the midst of it, technologists or users, Uber users, the three of us are, I prefer, Uber users, and we actually understand more than most. I remember we were, I think, the ninth people in the backbone of the internet. Now, by the way, I did not know what that meant. Now, I've been aware of the internet for years, and this is many, many decades ago. I've been aware of it forever. We didn't invent it. Al Gore invented it. We just kind of came across it. And then I remember this kid, Sky Dayton. He actually created what ended up being one of the biggest ISPs in the world, which he sold for $400 million before he had any revenue, gave me a little gift, gave me an email address. I said, that is so cool. But I didn't know anybody else who had one. Now, I remember the first time I saw the internet was an airplane. Surreptitiously, we're not supposed to turn those machines on. Billions of pieces of stuff flying across. We're on the internet, said my partner, Rodney. I said, oh, that's really cool. And then the kids in Champlain developed a browser that I became really a hit with friends. Because I could figure out what's that green rock that comes out of New Zealand called. I could actually research that. I also found that I became really limited in my impact on the company that I was raising, because whatever you do, don't give me the opportunity to do some research. that is superfluous. Now, I'm a shameless researcher, but I'm focused. The first time I had that machine, Philip, Steve, you got to have this. And that's the machine told me that I was going to have lunch, dinner at this Chinese restaurant in New York 3 days later. And I said, it's phenomenal. And pretty soon I was looking at how much do cows weigh in India rather than Pakistan. And then I said, if you don't take it off my desk, I'm going to throw it through a window, because I had become completely impotent. I can't get anything done. I've been sitting for 22 hours. Now, the point I'm making is that something that we ignore is, and it crystallized for me with this really brilliant group of people came in to talk us into a piece of technology they had, analytics. They found some, these are brilliant people. They live someplace, they live here, I live here. And they were telling us that in our quantitative analyses, they came up the alternate mathematical theoretical models, whatever, that deal effectively with tiny numbers. Because, you know, hey, A beat B by 2%, irrelevant, it's well within a range. They took that to where we would look at things that we call de minimis, nothing, irrelevant. They were able to really qualify the data. It's really cool. And I said, I'm shaking my head, I don't have a degree in quantum physics or mathematics, but I said, but I do run this business. I don't get it. I don't really understand. And then the CEO told me, it's just too complex. You're not going to understand this. I said, so you want to write a big old check on something I'm just never going to understand. How does that make sense, as you said, from a business standpoint? Now, I believe one of the things that we are ignoring, those of us that are up to here on this, is that most of the people out there who we impact or beneficiaries or losers of the game don't really get it. They know all about this AI stuff because it's on TV. Everybody's talking about it. Oh, good. AI is the end all be all, but they don't get it. See, we are talking here and they are over here. And that's really the masses. Now, right now, we talk endlessly about AI. Glad to do it. We have become experts on AI. Now, I was in AI in 1980, but that's infancy. That's man began walking upright right around then. But, you know, we talk about this endlessly. And I find myself in company of otherwise smart people who think AI is writing a letter to their boss or their supplier. That's what really is. Or, can you believe it? Somebody just sued ChatGPT because the kid did 3 years of research and then committed suicide with the help of this. That's what they focus on. And the biggest topic of all, we're all going to lose our jobs, the AI. Now, if you understand how that really works, and you know, you've got to be thinking laterally about AI. It's not vertical. It just gets better and better. It feeds on itself, feeds on itself. Hey, listen, I say this all the time. Elon Musk told me that the population of Germany has shrunk to 83.9 million. How do you know? Well, Elon Musk told me. I mean, Grok told me. Okay. To me, that is a tremendous research tool, but it's not. There's progress in the process. Okay, and the thing that my biggest fear, of course, we can get to this, is what happens to creativity? What happens to the people thing? Comments.
Well, you raised some massive points there.
You talked about change. See, massive I know that people like change. They just don't want to be changed.
Absolutely.
So how do you do that?
But Steve, that leads us into our next talking point. And I know Katz has got masses to say about AI implementations failing. So why do the top down AI implementations fail more often than bottom up innovations?
So here's the thing. So Gartner now is saying that 75% of all big organizations insist on using top-down change management. 75% of those are failing. The reason they're failing is because they're top-down. They don't understand what that change is going to mean for them. And if you look at the sort of physiology of what happens when you're when you have change done to you. Back to your point here, Stephen. So if you our brains haven't really evolved since we were on the savannah over the last however many thousands and thousands of years. We have two key states. One of them is the reward state, and that reward state is what keeps us attached and connected and want to keep safe our tribe. And then we've got the threat state. The threat state is the state that we the threat is that we developed to be able to run away from the saber-toothed tiger, if they indeed they were on the planet at the same time. So while we're in the threat state, we are incapable of making decisions. We're incapable of collaborating. We are fearful. We're nasty. We're aggressive. In the reward state, we're collaborative and communicative and innovative. We have all of the things whereby the reward state is what we should be trying to get our employees in. That's the change-ready state. But what we're doing with top-down is change arrives, and the physiological reaction to having change done to us is it puts us into the threat state. We feel stressed. We lose the power to make decisions. We lose the power to communicate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so every time we do change top down, we're having that same impact. So we're doing change after change after change after change. And every time we're physiologically having a reaction to that change because it's being done to us and we don't know what it is or what it's going to mean to us. And then you look at the reaction then of the change fatigue and the stress and the demotivation and the lack of ability to actually speak up or innovate or tell the truth because there is no psychological safety there. So any transformation that we have done in the past, and even people like Gartner are saying this now, you know, that there is an understanding, all of the data shows every change should be treated as an opportunity to start to embed a culture of psychological safety. Every change should be seen as a way of bringing the community that you're working with, your ecosystem or your staff, to feel that they own the change. Because when people feel they own the change and they're being really consulted, and again, if you look at the IKEA effect, if we co-create something, whether that be an object or a strategy, we're going to love that thing. We don't have a problem with it. We'll be in the reward state because that's ours. So we have to turn the paradigm upside down, and leadership needs to figure out what leadership means in a change-ready culture. And it's diametrically opposed to what leadership has meant, which is, I know best, you're going to do what I tell you, it's going to be good for you, just do it.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's very interesting that. I mean, the consensus style management has been around for decades, right? But actually, so few companies have this flat structure. And this is just like the major, major issue, especially now. It's getting even worse now because people are realizing that actually middle management isn't needed anymore. So they're getting rid of thousands and thousands of people from a lot of major, major corporations. We're in a very, very challenging place.
If you value the insights on influential visions, you'll be pleased to know that that is just the public version. Inside Monday Influencer, the indispensable weekly guide to success in business, career, life. You get a weekly email, which also has an audio version narrated personally by us. You get early access to uncut interviews, behind the scenes footage and intel. You get critical insights, unlocking AI and technology for your success. You can download cheat sheets, checklists, and many, many audios which will help you to become a better executive and a business person. Your risk is $1. Join us. The link.